Welcome to But Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined this week by Kyle.
How's it going?
And Charles.
Hello.
And this week, we are going to talk about photorealism in games and whatever the hell it is that NVIDIA was trying to sell us with DLSS5, their new AI filter. But before we get into all of that, what have y'all been enjoying this week that you want to talk about?
Well, I actually, with everything going on currently in the world, I decided to do a rewatch of the 2014 anime Akame ga Kill.
Okay.
Which, if you're not familiar, is basically a high fantasy anime about a young boy who travels into the capital of the empire he lives in to make his way as a soldier so that he can send back money to his impoverished town. Promptly nearly gets killed by corrupt nobles and is rescued by a group of assassins called Night Raid, who basically say eat the rich. They're going after corruption and trying to dismantle the imperial government so that when the revolutionary army comes, they can overthrow everything. I don't know why, but it felt really good watching that show right now. It's a great series. I really love it. It's a very unique blend of, it has like the weird jokey anime vibes, very high fantasy powered, but also very gritty. It looks at war and corruption and stuff in some very real terms. Zero plot armor and really great.
That's cool.
Yeah, a bit fan service-y at times. Nothing that would go so far as to be etchy, but it is there. Mm-hmm. But 24 episodes, phenomenal series. One of my favorite villains of all time, and Ezdeath is in it. It was. I got the idea to rewatch it, and I did. And I was like, man, you know, this feels really good right now. Seeing evil rich people get what's coming to them is like, I needed this.
Yeah, I get that. That sounds awesome. Also, I love a good limited series. I really just enjoy knowing that I'm going to get a complete story.
Yes.
And also, no shade to long-running series. I think every genre has that, but like a succinct story. It doesn't need to be 10 seasons. Sometimes you can get it in one or three or two, and it's just as enjoyable.
Absolutely.
What about you, Kyle? I've been seeing on Blue Sky that you've been doing a lot of posts about jazz albums.
So I started a thread of jazz albums because I listen to jazz every day. I teach jazz. I've played jazz for a long time. It's kind of like my big thing. So I've been doing that. So if you follow me on Blue Sky, you'll be able to see that daily thread. But the big thing that I've been enjoying lately is Nirvana, the band, the show. So I went.
Okay, I've heard about this. Tell me more.
I went in February to see the movie. I knew nothing about it other than some friends of mine who I think have good taste said this movie is one of the greatest movies, time travel movies, I've ever seen. And I was like, that's a bold take. So I went to see it. The premise is there are these two friends, Matt and Jay, Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll, the actors, creators, all of that. And they have a band called Nirvana the Band, and they want to play a show at the Rivoli, which is like a restaurant slash bar in Toronto where they live. And that's it. They're just doing different wacky plans to get a gig at the Rivoli. They had a web show from 2007, which I finally dug around and found online. So I've been watching that. They had a series in 2017 on Viceland, which I watched after watching the movie. And then obviously the movie, which comes out, hopefully, I believe soon on digital. So I'm going to get to watch it again. But it is insanely funny. Like every episode has a different premise, and it's usually around parodying a movie. So like Nirvana the Band, the show, the movie is parodying Back to the Future, and there's like some Hot Tub Time Machine references and like things like that. There's a Star Wars one. Like there's all sorts of just really funny parody, and they do it all unscripted, like out in public doing things. So when they make a giant banner, it's a picture of them that they took at a Sears portrait studio, and Jay's genitals are hanging out. That is an actual thing they did on the streets of Toronto, and the reactions from people are genuine reactions. And it is one of those.
That's insane.
Like the movie and the show, I'm just like, I don't know how you did this, both legally and physically, but it is one of the funniest things I've watched. It is quite enjoyable.
That's some high praise. I'll need to see that. Do you think it would be worth tracking down and watching the web series and the other revivals before the movie, or should I just go in blind?
I honestly, I think it's fine either way. There's, now that I'm watching through the shows, I'm seeing that there is so much that they, so the movie cuts back to footage that they filmed in 2008, around the time of this web series. So if you haven't seen it, you're not understanding what they're referencing, but you don't need to for the story. Like it's perfectly enjoyable. You're just, oh, it's their past selves and they're doing things. But as I've been watching back through it, like I'm looking forward to watching it again because I feel like I'm going to catch so many things, just little nods that I didn't see before. And I think that makes the humor just even better. But it's much easier to find the movie. It's much easier to see that when that comes after. I think they're working on like doing like an official re-release of the show. But right now it's kind of caught up in Wright's Hell. So it's been tough to kind of track down.
Yeah. And that, it sounds very... as you were describing the experience, like your, what you think that rewatch is going to be, very Arrested Development, where like the first time is great. And the second time you start realizing like all the little jokes and references and like set up things that went over your head the first time because you didn't know to look for them. And I love that style of humor and storytelling where things get richer the more you watch them instead of feeling rote or predictable. So that's cool. Charles, I was going to ask, Akame ga Kill, where can I watch that if I'm going to go into it?
I know Once Upon a Time, at least it was on Netflix, not sure if it still is, but it is on High Dive, which is, you know, your standard, I think it's like $7 or $8 for a month, or, you know, if you haven't had it before, that's probably a 30-day free thing
free
that
trial.
You could...
I could knock out 24 episodes in a month if I'm focused. We'll see. Really, there's other shows where I've been like, that's only 8 episodes. I'll power through it. And I'm on episode 5, and I have been for 2 months because I just didn't get back to it.
It can happen.
So Akame ga Kill, Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. And then for me, my thing is also inaccessible. I talked about it very, very briefly last week, but there is... So how familiar are either of you with, I guess, country music is where I'll start this?
Not too
vaguely.
Familiar.
Okay, so neither am I, but I know that there's this guy, Sturgill Simpson, who makes pretty solid music. He, in the last few years, has decided he doesn't like going by his name because he doesn't like hearing his name in public, and it's not someone that he knows. Like, it's kind of like that disappointment of like, oh, just everyone knows me. So he rebranded as Johnny Blue Sky, and his backing band is the Dark Clouds, and they just put out their second album called Mutiny After Midnight. And what makes this inaccessible is that for the first like month or two, maybe longer, it will not be on any streaming service. It will only be something that you can buy either from him online, like having a CD shipped to you, or at a record store. Mutiny After Midnight as an album is this very 1970s kind of like sleazy outlaw country with like a good amount of funk and disco to it, which was really surprising, and just kind of like absurd, over-the-top songwriting. The lyrics are not great, but he straight up said that was not the point of the album. He wanted an album where his band could show off a little bit, which is what this is. It's hard to recommend because I know that it's not super accessible. He uploaded it to YouTube 2 weeks before it debuted because he apparently just always thought it would be fun to leak his own music. So you can, if you know where to poke around on the internet, you can find digital copies to listen to. The title track is called, or not the title track, the first track is Make America Fuck Again. And it's just about how America can and should be better. And then the second track is called Excited Delirium, and it's about the ineffectiveness of militarized police and ICE. And that kind of gives you an idea of what this album is lyrically and thematically. And it's just great music. It's just really fun to listen to. So that's my recommendation. Mutiny After Midnight by Johnny Blue Skies and the Dark Clouds.
Nice.
It will be on streaming eventually, I think they said, because I want to say this was released through like Atlantic or Warner, like a big record company. So I'm like, there's no way they're not going to eventually put it somewhere. But at least at launch, they agreed to let him do this thing where he's trying to drive traffic to record stores, which I appreciate because, I mean, I'm very lucky that I'm in Portland and we have a lot of good record stores and very successful ones that are not going anywhere. But I know a lot of places don't have that. So, yeah. But I think that's it. So before we hop into this conversation, where can people find you online, assuming that you want to be found?
People can find me at Gatsu083 on Blue Sky. I don't post a ton, but I am on there.
You can find me in my incredible jazz threads /soccer post/everything else at kfoley, F-O-L-E-Y, F-L, on Blue Sky.
Nice. I do need to go through and start listening to those albums that you've been putting out, because I know that I appreciate jazz. I just don't seek it out as much. I think right now the album that I've listened to the most is Ryo Fukui's Scenery. I don't know if you know that one.
I do not, but I'm adding that to my list to potentially add to the thread.
It's a 70s jazz piano album from Japan, and it's great.
Yeah, I mean, people can see on the thread. I've got it saved right now. There's like a ton of, like, it starts with Count Basie, and then it gets into, like, there's a little Masayoshi Takanaka in there. There's some Snarky Puppy. Like, I try to keep it very varied and different. And honestly, it's a lot of just like, what am I listening to today? So what did the algorithm give to me? Or what did I have a giant like spreadsheet of stuff that will be mine that I will not share. It's my top secret favorite jazz album list. And I am slowly sharing those with people.
Sometimes you wake up and you just know what you're going to listen to.
Yep. 100%.
Also, I just put that name in the chat. And you can find me on Blue Sky at Most Always Alex. Technically, I still have my name on the Hell site, but I don't really use it. And with that, let's talk about it. So, DLSS 5. That's why we're talking about this now. This is NVIDIA's new AI filter, I think is how they're pitching it. It applies photorealistic lighting and materials to existing assets.
Well... yeah, I mean,
is how they're selling it.
Well, supposedly, like, I've heard some more, and supposedly, you know, like, it's not supposed to, at least what I heard comments from someone over at NVIDIA, it's supposed to be something that, like, the designers themselves can interact with, and you, like, it's not supposed to just be we apply this after while you're playing it sort of thing, apparently. It's supposed to be something that they work with. But yeah, that's definitely what it looks like, isn't it?
All of their examples were from existing games, where they're like, "Oh, here's this game," and they all look the same with our stuff. Yeah,
they made every character look the same. It's like,
well, and the one that confused me was the screenshot from Requiem, because I played Requiem and it looked better than the before picture that they used. That also had me raise an eyebrow, because I was like, this feels like you intentionally picked a bad version of Requiem, like a low end PC running it, and then added your filter to be like, look how good this is now.
I would not put it past a company, for sure.
It's, you know, as a technology, problematic for kind of obvious reasons. Like, the tech is opt-in by the developer, but there's a lot of concern about how it's going to get used and how much control they'll have, whether or not this will be nuanced enough to follow the art direction of a game, or if it will just ignore it to apply what it thinks is right. Which, like, have either of you played Requiem?
I have not.
Okay, so the whole, like, I would say the first, like, hour or two, lighting is insanely important, and even beyond that, but definitely in the first hour or two, like, lights are a core mechanic to the game. So something that's like, let us mess with your lighting, to me feels especially risky. But yeah, so this is a conversation about that filter, but more broadly about photorealism, which I guess, just to get us started, how do you both, like, kind of off the bat, feel about photorealism in games?
I don't mind it. It's not a thing that I'm inherently opposed to, and it's something I'm sure we'll talk about as we continue to get into, like, the specifics of it. But when done well, in service of the story or the gameplay, I think it's awesome. I think if it is a tool to help show your world, for a while I was really nitpicky, where once we kind of crossed, like, the probably GTA 5 was probably, I feel like when the threshold was crossed, at least on a popular level, where it was like, man, this is like as real as games can get. And then everything started going after that. And for a while I was like, man, yeah, I want to play things that look real. I'm done with the pixel art or the weird 3D stuff. And then I've kind of reverted back in recent years, where I appreciate art direction so much more, because making things look realistic, making a game in Unreal Engine 5 and making it look super real is like, okay, but now we're at a point where it just doesn't feel like there's any life behind it. It doesn't feel like there's anything interesting about it. It's just real for the sake of being real. Not that there aren't games that do it well or do it to serve a purpose, but there's so many things where it's like you're just trying to showcase how many pores are on this rock because you can, and I don't know how that's really servicing the game, so I don't really care.
Yeah. Charles?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say I'm probably definitely in a similar boat. I mean, there are games that, you know, their fundamental design, you know, you look at something like The Last of Us, and of course, that's a game whose story and setting feels like it should be as grounded in reality as you can make it. You know, that's
It would be a hard sell if it looked like Cuphead.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like that, you know, the tone, the everything it's going for wants to be that. But there is definitely a point where, depending upon the storytelling and the kind of things you're doing, where realism becomes detrimental. The big one that I've that's bounced around in my head, and I think and I even used, like, when I was pitching this concept for the meeting, was like Overwatch. How much worse would Overwatch? How forgettable would that game be if everyone just looked like a normal everyday person? If Reinhardt was a
photorealistic gerbil fighting a photorealistic woman,
with a weird looking ape in a space suit, like it would have no personality. And that's something that I feel like a lot of stories need, because I mean, like, you know, like that's something that sets it apart from something like, from what I remember as having briefly seen it, of like Concord, where Concord was moving more into that area of the characters did look more normal size. They were they didn't have that personality and that flair that Overwatch characters have, because they'll make them a little taller or the legs too long because Tracer's a sprinter. So I think that that's something that, and the other thing I also feel, especially as we move into more and more focus about games lasting past their launch point, is style ages better. As we update graphics and stuff, and you go back and you look at PS3 games that we, at the time, we were like, oh my God, you know, you go back and look at Heavy Rain again, which was a mind-blowing technical Master Chief, then you're like, ooh, God, that looks so bad. Yeah. But when it's stylized, you know, gorgeous pixel art is gorgeous pixel art. Chrono Trigger still looks like a banger 30 years later.
It's, I mean, one of the best looking GameCube games is still Wind Waker, because they went with cel shading instead of photorealism.
Yeah. For sure. So, like, there's definitely a lot of nuances, but it has its place. It definitely has its place.
I think I would echo a lot of what you all said. Like, this idea of, like, pursuing... I mean, and games have been on this, basically, I would say, since the jump to 3D is when this kind of really started. And it's been a more recent thing, because now it's starting to feel more possible, more in reach. And I think it sets up too, I mean, like you both highlighted, there's this false dichotomy of like, is stylized better or is photorealism better? And obviously, like, the conclusion that we're going to hit on this episode, obviously, is that they're tools to be used at the right time, and that there is not one is better than the other. It's about how you apply those tools. I think for me too, part of it is, could you, you know, not time-wise, but like budget-wise, could you make a more interesting game if you were spending less on making it look photorealistic and more on like developing exciting mechanics and good math behind it and everything? Which, you know, that's a whole game developer conversation. But it, you know, when you see something like Stardew Valley that obviously isn't photorealistic, but people are getting thousands of hours of entertainment out of it and love it because it's so mechanically rich, like it there is a balance to it. So when you hear things like, you know, oh, we had one guy spend 300 hours just animating Batman's cape for this new game, and it's like, well, that sucks. Like, that's 300 hours you could have spent on other things. Not that the cape doesn't need to look good, but, you know, because they'll do that, and then the cape still clips through things because you just can't do it perfectly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so this, I guess, yeah, to back up, like, this episode is not going to be specifically about that AI filter. That was just our jumping off point. And also, I want to say photorealism as a pursuit is not exclusive to games. I think basically anything that can make a picture, people have tried to make it as photorealistic as possible. like pencil drawings, oil painting, whatever, people are going to be like, can I trick your eye into thinking this is a picture instead of, you know, human made art?
Well, I think
is cool. I like those things are impressive. And I think that impressiveness is maybe part of the problem, is that there's an assumed like this, a lot of work went into this, and not that it isn't work, but that it's somehow more impressive to do that than to create a fully realized stylized world for a video game.
There's such a difference too, though, between like somebody doing like a pencil art or a painting to make it look realistic. Like that is purely down to the skill of the person, and photorealism in games is more down to, yes, it requires a lot of work. I'm not trying to downplay the ability that it takes to do that, because I could never do it, but you have programs assisting you in doing that. You have programs and you have assets that are being designed. Like it is a much more collaborative process between both the artist and the tool and other artists. Whereas if somebody shows me a painting that they made that looks like it's just an actual picture of something, like that to me is mind-blowing, because all you did that with was physical tools. Like there's such a, and I think people conflate the like, oh, people are impressed with the, you know, is it steak or is it cake? Like people are impressed by those things because it tricks your mind, because you don't know how it's possible. Whereas when you get photorealism in games, and it's like, we understand how it's possible. I understand how you did it. The tools that you're using are just getting better, and you can create these things that are better quality. So that's, I think, where there's such a difference, and that's why you're seeing people react to these filters and things like that in a more vitriolic way, and they're so upset with it and bothered by it, because it's like, what you're doing is not, you're actually taking away from the little nuances that these artists did in these tools, and it's not really, it's not impressive. You're not doing anything creative or challenging.
Yeah. I'd agree with that, because I think I know I had a friend, this is like a decade ago, but she would do these 5-6 feet tall, pretty close to photorealistic drawings, like using a pencil on a gigantic sheet of paper, and would like draw her husband or a bee or whatever, you know, she decided to do. And she made some insane art. And I was like, this is genuinely nuts that you're just doing this in your apartment. With like a reference photo for what it should look like. And then, yeah, like you're saying, like, oh, but then you hop into Unreal Engine and you, you know, get the settings right and it renders. And that's a different skill set, because again, this is not something that we could do. We're not here to dunk on that. But this tool and this idea that things should be, because one of the games that they demoed this for was the Hogwarts Legacy game. And I feel like that game's not supposed to be photorealistic. Like even the picture they used, it's like kind of a goofy proportioned person, isn't it?
I feel like that's the case, if I remember correctly. I think I know which character you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I don't want to see like a yassified Dobby. Like Dobby already isn't real. He doesn't need to look real. Like it's a weird.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a weird choice.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like just like purely from like the artist, from like, you know, the outside of the AI of it all, situation, I feel like I feel like there's a corporate inclination towards wanting photorealism for a couple of reasons, one of which is that I feel like when done well, it's less risky, because most people, if something looks real, it looks good. Like, there isn't a question of does it, like, you can style something and the graphics can be gorgeously rendered, but if you don't like that color scheme, you don't like the way a character is designed, you may not like it and you may not buy the game. But few people don't buy a game because it looks too real.
That's rarely the thing that's going to get me.
That's going to, you know, like, you usually it's like, oh, that looks really great. You know, maybe I'm not interested because I don't want to play a real world game about, you know, surviving an apocalypse or cooking in my kitchen, whatever. But that generally isn't a turnoff, whereas style design can be. And I feel like the other thing that is a bit more deeply baked into the culture, even beyond gaming, is this fixation with live action is the ultimate means of storytelling. As someone who is a big animation fan, you know, we can go into all kinds of, you know, oh, live action, you know, like back in, who was it? Was it Ebert that made the famous claim that video games will never be able to tell stories like cinema?
I think so.
You know, like those sorts of things where like it's just inherently less because it's not live. So we need to be as live as we can be. I feel like is another piece of the puzzle as well that like, and I also feel which, like,
sorry, no, I want to interject real quick. If you didn't see the news, I don't know if it was new today, but that Val Kilmer, rest in peace, is going to be in a movie. So even the whole like, oh, if it's not live, it's not art. It's like, okay, how you feel about this?
That's now, like now there's
this techno necromancy.
Yeah, no, absolutely, for sure. I mean, and it's weird because I do feel like, I feel like bringing it back to gaming, I do feel like there is an element of like where more realism made a lot of sense. Cause like you mentioned, like when we moved to 3D initially, like basically there was a time period, I feel like in like the PS1, PS2 into PS3 where improving graphics almost fundamentally made them more realistic. You know, when we were in a situation where, you know, Cloud had block hands and Lara Croft's breasts were a single triangle across her chest, like anything better than that is more realistic. And that kind of became the Strive. And then in the PS3 and 360 eras, gaming started to mature with its audience. And we started getting Call of Duties, Kane and Lynch, like these grounded shooters, or Heavy Rain that's about trying to catch a serial killer. So the material started becoming more like, oh, this is stuff that makes sense for a more realistic art style. And happily, you know, that was never the sole thing. There's great games in all kinds of different styles all throughout those periods. But now it feels more so than ever like wanting to make something photorealistic when it doesn't need to be shouldn't even be a like, there's so much more you can do. And so many games showcase that, whether they are huge budget games like Overwatch or things like Hades that just like, yeah, they could have designed those characters to look like chiseled, sexy, real life gods, but they would not be as memorable as they are.
No, they're chiseled, sexy cartoon gods.
And that will always be superior when done right in my book. But I'm an anime fan, so, you know, that's not a surprise to anyone. But, yeah, so, I mean, there's just, I feel like there's a lot.
Yeah, there is. And it's interesting because all of these older ways of making games never went away. I mean, even, pixel art was always seen as like, oh, it's retro, it's fun, it's whatever, and some games just need to be that art style. But I'm even seeing games coming out now that are intentionally designed to look like the start of the 3D era. Crow Country is a great example, very much meant to look sort of like it runs on a PS1, even though it doesn't. And so people are, you know, embracing these art styles across all of it. It's just that photorealism, like you were saying, like live action is still being held up as this pinnacle, or mimicking live action, you know, doing mocap on everyone's face. I remember that was a big thing with LA Noir marketing, was we had real actors and we filmed their faces and converted it into game, and it's the most realistic thing you'll ever see. And I'm like, yeah, that's like fine and cool. And for this one thing, it was the thing, but we don't need to do that for everything. And, you know, and we're not to, you know, I'm not going to say like, oh, everything's going that route. Like, we don't have photorealistic Mario, you know, because God has not thrown us into that hell yet.
Now that you put it out there, it's going to happen.
I know, I shouldn't have said it. I regretted it when it left my mouth. But yeah, like all of this stuff is still around. Like, yes, we have games with ray tracing and perfect light bounces and reflective surfaces, but then we also just have like pixelated blobs and we have ugly polygon, you know, messes that are imitating those other old polygon messes. It's all an experience. And I think you highlighted too, like some games really benefit from the art style more than others. I think horror is maybe the one space where I'm like, photorealism makes sense because it's scarier when it feels like it could happen. But I've played some phenomenal horror games that don't even sort of look like real life. Like, even that rule is not hard and fast. Crow Country is a good example. Lone Survivor is a side-scrolling pixel game that is a zombie game. That one's great. But Last of Us is also good, and it's photorealistic.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think genre sometimes can inform the right art style, but also I think at the end of the day, the game is what is going to inform the art style. Like, the examples that came to mind kind of going off of your Overwatch thing was we have like Call of Duty, which is trying to be a little grounded. And I think that that's kind of where photorealism shines as a tool, is when you're trying to ground something or make it feel that way. Call of Duty might not be the best example. That game has gotten kind of silly. But then on the other end, you have Fortnite, which is even sillier and would look ridiculous if photorealistic. It has to be animated and cartoony.
I want to play photorealistic Fortnite where my Peter Griffin skins look absurdly realistic. I think that
it just looks like a heavy set man from the Northeast.
Just have, but that, and then also come in with Frieza from Dragon Ball and also have him look photorealistic. Don't ask me how it would work. Don't ask me.
See, what I what I don't like about what you just said is that now I want to Google photorealistic Frieza, no, and I know don't. I'm going to be upset.
No, and I think the other thing too that's kind of not really talked about as much, but I think it's a huge driver behind a lot of the reason why people prefer non-photorealistic game is game performance. That's the whole reason behind DLSS and all this technology that NVIDIA's been doing is, in theory, to make games run better. So when they were doing technology to introduce ray tracing, and when they were doing these things to just improve things that were there and to make them run better, so developers do things like that, was where people, maybe initially there was pushback, but once you saw it in use, the selling point was, we are going to allow developers to improve the quality while also allowing the performance to improve. When you see a tech demo that just shows you completely changing the style, it almost feels like it's gone away from the purpose. But the benefit of highly specialized art styles is, especially if you're not going for a hyper-realistic, really graphic-intensive thing, you can then channel that into performance. I can get a significantly higher frame rate on Fortnite than I can in Call of Duty. And I know that's mm-hmm. just the example we're using, but there's so many things where you can typically make things run better if you're not trying to make them look as good. Now, some developers, cough, cough, Game Freak with Pokemon, cough, cough, will take shortcuts.
Yeah.
And they will both make it look bad and not perform well. And they'll use excuses as, you know, hardware limitations and things like that. But when done right, you can do these hyper-specialized things, which, yes, it serves the artistic purpose as well, like we've talked about, and games benefit from that, but it also just makes the games function better. You don't need as expensive hardware to run it. You can run these things on a phone or a Nintendo Switch or a cheap budget PC, and you don't need to have a $4,000 build. You see some of these games coming out today, and it's the minimum specs are things that people can't afford. And so
yeah,
there's
absolutely.
that's also the kind of trade-off that I feel like maybe doesn't get discussed as much, but it is super, super important.
Well,
yeah.
And to kind of go along in that same train of thought, I feel like another element that can be brought into it is also the impact that development time can have on narrative. Because like, I play all kinds of games. I mean, I'm a big player of Wuthering Waves. I cover it regularly for the site. The new update's going live shortly after we record this. And like, that game, I think, looks beautiful. It's designed well. A new update comes out every 6 weeks. Now, obviously, they have multiple teams. They have way more time than that to do it. But like, you know, compare and contrast that to, you know, like, because the Last of Us multiplayer game got canceled by Sony, there's the possibility that we won't see a Naughty Dog game this console generation. Because we don't know
That's
when
nice.
That space one is coming out. I mean, it will probably be cross-gen, but still, that we'll nearly miss an entire thing. Like, so that pursuit and that push for fidelity and realism and stuff, how tough is it? How much harder is it for a game narrative, or even if you want to look at it from a more business standpoint, a brand, a franchise, to get sunk into public mindset if you only see it once or twice a decade? Like,
yeah. And you know, that actually brings up what all you've been saying. I can't believe that this is the thing I'm going to point to, but Duke Nukem Forever. Do you guys know about Duke Nukem Forever?
Of course, yes. I played that game.
So Duke Nukem Forever came out on the Xbox 360. Duke Nukem Forever started development on the Nintendo 64.
It did.
And part of why that took so long is because the director was insistent that it had to come out on state-of-the-art whatever engine was the hot thing, the new thing. It had to be that. Like, multiple times he was like, scrap everything you've done that can't be translated to the new engine. We're using the new engine. This game has to be state of the art. And I'm realizing now, I don't even know that photorealism is the thing that's the quote unquote enemy here. I think it's that state of the art mentality of like, if it's not on the newest thing, then we shouldn't be doing it. It's like, no, you should be doing it on whatever tool enables you to make the game you want to make and tell the story you want to tell.
Well, I mean, that's like all of the trouble that I know for years they always said BioWare went through with Frostbite. With the EA Frostbite engine that was originally made for Battlefield, but yeah, it's like, we want everyone using this. And it's like, this isn't designed to run an RPG, but okay.
Yeah, and I guess we can. And that's where you get like goofy stuff where it's like, oh yeah, actually the overlay is an object that is just like floating in front of you. It's not actually an overlay because we didn't know how to do it in this engine.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so like, yeah, no, I definitely think that like that wanting to be the biggest, the shiniest, and, you know, and it, you know, it helps. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people who are attracted to the most gorgeous looking thing out there. And like, you know, we said earlier, you know, the, you know, realism is easy to identify as if it's good or not. You know, there was all kinds of style games that, you know, whether or not pixel art looks good, you know, or not, whether, you know, those sorts of things are generally as universally agreed upon. So, and or some styles just, you know, even when you see them and you correlate with something, like people see a 2D, like the HD 2D stuff that Square has been doing, you see that even before you know the game, you're like, oh, this is a turn-based JRPG because it's pixel art in the modern age on a Nintendo. It's got to be that. So like, whereas realism just kind of can be applied to a lot of things, but it's a thing.
Definitely, because then you get just stylized, well, not stylized realism, you get things that have to be added in, like color filters and different things to set yourself apart, otherwise everything looks kind of samey. And I mean, that granted, this is where you get into, like, in filmmaking there's an award for costuming, because it's not like, obviously it's a real, like, someone had to wear a shirt, but it's like, well, did you do a good job of making an era accurate shirt for your 1970s period piece? Like, that becomes the question. I think it's just interesting because I don't hate photorealism, but I don't need it on everything. And I definitely don't need an AI slop version of it.
Oh, for sure.
I think if anything, I appreciate the push to make it easier, because I think what we're going to run into now that photorealism is fairly in reach for, I think, every major console, like even the Requiem on Switch 2 apparently even looks really good due to like some upscaling tricks and interesting things they tried there. But if everything is hitting this thing that we saw as the pinnacle of graphics, then how do we justify the next generation of consoles? Because you did it. You got it. And, you know, like, if the PlayStation 6 and whatever Xbox manages to cobble together, if those look like real life, I don't know that I need the thing that comes after that. I, you know, it just kind of puts the kibosh on console sales if we have things that can run it. And then the investment needs to be into tools to make that run better, like we were talking about. Yeah. And I don't think that that's what DLSS 5 is. I think it really is just it seems like they're trying to throw their hat in the AI ring and keep that hype train going.
Yeah, I was listening to Kinda Funny, and they had a letter written in from an anonymous dev who was like, this is to make it so that they all look the same, so that it'll smooth stuff out and they can lay off more animators, because you can get it get it close enough and then DLSS 5 will do the rest. And stuff. Now, whether or not that's true, obviously, who knows? But like, that doesn't sound far-fetched given what we've seen in the industry over the last few years. Like, you know, if we the fewer people we can have, because games are a mature market where you can only sell to so many people. So how do we make more money if we have fewer people developing them? Like, so it certainly doesn't seem outside of the realm of possibility on that end. And like you said, I mean, the more photorealistic you get, you need mocap actors, you need mocap equipment, people who can translate those things into real life, cloth, collision, all so much stuff.
Actually, wait, yeah, are you just shifting the cost center? Is that all this is actually doing?
That's.
I mean, I guess it's cheaper to pay one mocap actor than 10 animators, but still feels bad.
True.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, and it's, I think the other thing, when you said mature market, it kind of reminded me, is that I feel like photorealism is equated with grown-up stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of
like
course.
It's, you know, if someone sees you playing Wind Waker, it's like, oh, that's a kid game. But if someone sees you playing Twilight Princess, maybe it's a grown-up game.
That is.
Maybe.
That's certainly also a thing.
And that, I mean, that's its own like cultural shift that we have to get over. It's the same. It's very much in line with the whole animation is for children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's super not, it's a medium. It is not a genre, and people need to get that through their head with film and television. But that's kind of the video game equivalent. And I think, you know, we've all seen that. We've all seen people be like, oh, you play Nintendo games. Those are for children. I play games where you kill people, and that's for adults.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, you know what's dumb and not helpful to the discourse? What you just said.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I again, I think there is space for both of these art styles. Like, there are games that I play that if they were not photorealistic, it probably wouldn't hit the same. Red Dead Redemption 2 wouldn't hit the same if it didn't look realistic. It, not that it wouldn't hit. That game has, you know, a really fun gameplay style. It has an engaging story with emotional beats. But if it was Woody from Toy Story getting spoilers for an old game, getting TB, you'd feel a little bit different.
There's got to be a, like, mod for that.
Oh, I hope so. It's, have you not seen the sheer glut of Requiem mods?
Shrek?
Yeah, there's Shrek. There's giving Leon a hamburger car. There's, I saw one today that turns one of the monsters into the xenomorph. I thought that was pretty cool. We could just do a whole episode on how mods are both really great for helping people enjoy games and also really dumb for what people do with them.
Truth. Yeah.
I think, oh, sorry, go for it.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, bringing up mods, like, it's actually funny because, like, that was, like, my knee-jerk reaction when I saw the DLSS 5 thing. I was like, oh, this looks like a soulless mod. It looks like you're doing a mod of the game almost, which is, like, I know that's not at all what it is, but just, that was just my thought. Oh, you're like, modding it, only not in a way anyone asks for, and I don't know, can we turn it off? Of course, I mean, also, like, it's been pointed out that I guess, like, that demo was running on a computer with, like, 2 5090s, so nothing anyone's going to be doing anytime in the near future.
I would say, isn't that, like, $10,000 worth
something
of
like that. Something like that. Yeah, it's like, okay. But.
Yeah, it's obscene. And I think that that's kind of the other thing. I'm intrigued by their decision to showcase the technology with games that are already out that people have played, only because that adds to the feeling that it's a mod, that it's tacked on, that it's not a tool that they're making for developers to use.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I would rather them be like, hey, here's a game that's not out yet, but it's using this technology. Here's what it looks like without the mod. Here's what it looks, or without the filter. Here's what it looks like with it.
The tone of it would have been completely different if they had come out and been like, hey, we're here at Capcom. We sat down with the animators, you know, this is what they did with it. They had like a soundbite from one of them saying, this is why I enjoyed working with this tech, making it seem like this is something that people outside of C-suite actually may want. But the fact that there wasn't any of it, that there's been reports that developers at Capcom were like, we found out this tech exists the same way you did. Like, it's just like, oh, God. Yeah, it just gives that tone deaf of you're saying this is for the devs, but you haven't actually, you know, discussed it with them, you know. Kind of like when that abusive partner says, I'm doing this for you, but are you really?
Yeah. Are you? Yeah. And it's also frustrating because, like, the degree to which it changed the appearance in some of those pictures they were showing, it was severe enough that it did feel like it was kind of just ignoring what the game was meant to look like.
Yeah. Which they have said, apparently.
Which makes me nervous about it as a technology.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What do you think, Kyle?
Alex pointed out the whole thing about it being interesting that they're choosing games that are already out. And I think that is this is obviously not a tool that I guess I won't say obviously, but this doesn't feel like this is a tool that is really in the hands of developers right now. This is a thing that NVIDIA is doing, and the conspiracy-minded part of my brain is that this is just them trying to continue to sustain the AI bubble, and so the more that they can do to go, look at how we're using this, and that maybe not a thing that's going to be... Even if DLSS 5 makes it into the mainstream for developers, it's going to be radically different than it is now, that this is just something to do for the investors to make them feel good about where things are at. And that sucks. That feels gross. There's so much of this that like NVIDIA has proven over the last couple of years, not that there's really any good corporations, but they've really proven over the last couple of years that they are as scummy as it gets with trying to make this AI thing happen, and the sheer amount of money involved. There is no reason why NVIDIA should be valued at what it is. This all just feels like a giant farce. And so much of this too, you have what had started as good technology back with RTX and the way it's developed since then with introducing frame generation, to now it's become trying to almost take over an industry. And it's, man, it's really gross to see. I hope that the developers of those games were not a part of this presentation, that they didn't sit there and go, yeah, let's, we're going to run it on our end and see what it does and give you the footage, let you use it. Like, I'm hoping this is just NVIDIA doing its thing. But also, we've seen in the games industry, there's not a lot of great studios out there that are really taking care of their people. So I wouldn't put it past these people to go, oh yeah, you know, you got some CEO who knows nothing about developing games who looks at it and goes, oh sure, I can make it look realistic. I don't care if it looks like a direction. You were saying earlier, like, if they, you know, oh, we can get rid of artists and take the job and make it easier, you know, why not? So it just, it feels so shady. And I think that's the worst part of all of this, is that it's not just a matter of, you know, are we making games more realistic? It's the technology is evolving to replace workers in a way that doesn't improve the quality.
Yeah, definitely. Also, when you said that it's a huge farce, I really thought you were going to say it's a huge fart, and I wasn't going to disagree.
It's that as well. I'll give you that. Giant wet fart.
I was like, yeah, Kyle, it is a huge fart. But yeah, I think you're right. It's like, they didn't send this back in time for people to use. This did not touch the production cycle of that Hogwarts game at all, even for a second. And it just, it's bad. It feels bad. I don't, this, you know, on this podcast, we have been famously anti-AI, and I don't know why you would champion the unemployment machine, like why you would want that to be a thing that succeeds. Especially when we don't have a society or infrastructure that supports that much unemployment. But yeah, ultimately, I don't see the benefit of this other than to stockholders' wallets. And that's the part that I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty good not engaging this. I don't need it. I'm not going to turn that filter on. It just seems... And I also... I question... like you were saying, like, is this them propping up the AI bubble? And I do question that, because we have pretty damn good lighting and textures in video games as is. Even like playing older, like playing like Arkham Knight is like, is it perfect? No. Is it still pretty damn good? Yeah. And that game's like 10 years old. So this is, it's not icing on the cake, because I don't think it's good. I think it's fondant on the cake. I think it is trying to make something pretty, but ultimately making it less appealing as what it is supposed to be as an end product. You know, I don't know if you guys have strong feelings on fondant. I don't like it. I think it tastes bad. I think the texture is terrible, and this is fondant on the cake.
Yeah. No, and I think there's another thing too that I thought of while you were saying that is, is there some of this that's like a nefarious, oh, we can use this to just upscale old games and resell them for more money because people crave this photorealistic look? My hope is, and from what it seems from the feedback of this introduction stuff, is that's not going to go over well. That is not, people already don't like half-assed remakes and remasters. So the idea that, but I feel like there's so much delusion up at the C-suite level for all of these companies that, that, It is going to get worse before it gets better in terms of just striving to make everything look quote unquote hyper realistic, because obviously some of this isn't even looking realistic with DLSS 5. But I think the end game that we could see in a good way is that when shit hits the fan, you're starting to see already more developers starting to go for more hyper stylized stuff again. Those things are becoming popular again. That the consumers ultimately hold the power. And if you're not going to spend your money on stuff like this, if you're not going to go buy the new $4,000 graphics card to run these things, that's what makes the decision for them. So if you see a game that's got weird, quirky graphics, I played a demo recently for a game called Nutmeg, which is like a deck building retro soccer game. And everything is like handcrafted, old school feeling. Like those are the kind of things that if you like that and you see that and go, man, this is awesome, support it. And then at the same time, if you're seeing things, games that are coming out that are made to look more realistic, but you can tell that there's, especially when you hear developers talk about it in his heart, you know, be smart about where you spend your money. And I think that's ultimately what makes the decision about whether this stuff becomes popular, whether these filters mm-hmm. and these types of changes become the mainstream usage. As much as obviously these giant companies want to cut costs, they also need to sell games and they need to sell products. And they're not going to do that if people decide, I'm not going to allow that. We're already seeing it with AI adoption where people aren't spending money on these chatbots. They're just using them, but there's no money being made. And they're just giant mm-hmm. money pits. Let them keep being money pits. Let these people keep sinking billions and billions of dollars in. It's going to burst and fail. And then eventually something will rebuild better out of the ashes from there. At least I should say, hopefully, yeah. I guess maybe I'm wrongly optimistic given the general state of the world, but I would like to hope that that's a thing that can eventually revert back in a way that is successful, yeah. in a way where like a game studio surviving is not, did you sell 7 billion copies, but it was, did you just make your budget back and a little bit extra, and now you get to make something cool and creative again. I'd like to, as we're seeing the changes in the visual and the gameplay side of games, seeing those changes on the business side, because ultimately all of this is being driven by the business side and not the creative side.
Oh yeah. And I think I'm right there with you with that, you know, potentially misguided optimism that this technology can crash and burn and then we can find the actual good applications of it and use it there instead of using it literally everywhere, top to bottom, left to right. And yeah, I think that this is a misapplication in that regard. And it's been great. I mean, granted, I know the internet's not necessarily where you're getting the most accurate temperature read, but seeing pretty much every post about this be like, hey, actually, this sucks and we all hate it. I have yet to see anybody say, I really, really love DLSS 5. Everyone seems pretty against it. And that is a good feeling.
I want all of my video game characters to look like a Snapchat filter.
Absolutely. Yes. Here's the thing. If they would have added that, if they would have added dumbass social media face filters to games, I would put that mod on Resident Evil Requiem way faster than I would put this one on.
Oh, in a heartbeat.
Like, yeah, let's, you know, like let Leon run around with this like cartoonish anime like eyes and like blushing cheeks. Like, yeah, fine, whatever. Like, I will play that. That's fun. I do not want this.
For sure.
Yeah, I think all that to say, like, again, play what you want. Games are gonna look good. Games are gonna look good without being photorealistic. Don't use this, you know, NVIDIA nonsense, because I don't think it's good. I think also a good game is built around the gameplay and the graphics are added on. Any game that is built around the graphics and the gameplay is added on is maybe not great.
Yes, I would say that's probably a safe assumption. Gameplay and narrative, if applicable, for sure.
Yeah. Like, it's, yeah, it just, the graphics are nice.
I will.
Going back to the same stupid analogy, the graphics are always going to be icing on the cake, and I think this AI filter is fondant, but like, yeah, it really is just like it's a little bit of flavor. It's a little bit of style on the end of the product. But the thing, like, yes, I'm looking at the game, but the thing I'm engaging with is the gameplay.
Yeah. As long I am far more likely to put 40 hours into a game that has great gameplay, great narrative, and the visuals are fine. I mean, obviously, you know, like, it can't be garbage. But, you know, or in a style that is very well executed, but I'm not really into the neon punk thing, but man, I'm really invested in this character, so I'm going to keep going. Yep. You know, like, then that's far more likely to work out than, oh my God, I booted this up and my eyes were blown away, but why does he keep walking off the cliff? Yeah, I mean, yeah. Obviously that's going to be a deal breaker much quicker, but.
Yeah. I don't know. It's the same way that I kind of felt and still feel about, like, 4K when it started being a thing, where it's like, I don't need to see the pores on someone's nose.
No.
I am watching their face. Like, no. This is more than most people actually need to enjoy a movie.
And honestly, thinking about it, you know, having reframed the discussion for a moment in that discussion about narrative versus visuals and all that stuff, I think that's the place where, like we said earlier, in a way, that stylization in some ways is much better. Because you can actually, it is more easy to heavily reinforce concepts when you're like, oh, you know, the sky of this world's going to be maroon. Why? Because it's a fantasy world and this is a rough, low energy game. So the sky's going to be maroon and it's going to work with these other themes we're doing. Or the characters have this aesthetic thing to them because it unifies them and it will work into this plot point we're doing. And doing these sort of stylization things can enhance, you know, it's kind of like the trying to apply it to like realism and stuff. It's kind of like, you know, whenever we see one of those movies that it's all black and white, except for the red objects, yep. Those are going to pop. Like, it breaks the realism, but you know why it's happening and yes. Stuff. And style does so much more. The more that you're willing to expand your style outside of solely realistic elements gives you more flex. Though, again, you know, like, the restrictions of realism can be used to create groundedness and stuff like that, which can be just as powerful. But it's easier to build theme when you are willing to go outside of what is real, I think.
Yes. This will be my final thought, and then I will open it up to other final thoughts, because this is going to be a bad note to end the episode on as far as it's not serious. The idea that everything should be photorealistic is how you get Robin Williams playing Popeye. And if you don't know what I mean by saying that, Google Robin Williams Popeye. Didn't need to happen, but it did happen.
After you do that, go look up photorealistic Frieza. Those will both make your day.
We're just giving people terrible things to look up.
These men do not represent me.
You don't have a terrible, terrible thing to wish upon listeners?
I don't need to wish terrible things upon our listeners. The world is doing plenty of that for me.
That's fair. But yeah, do you guys have any final thoughts, or should we wrap it up?
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, just, you know, like we said, you know, I think...
Kyle? I see that photo of realistic Frieza in the chat, and I'm upset.
Yeah, no, I mean, like we've said, I think that, you know, there's some understandable reasons, I should say, for why photorealism kind of got into the zeitgeist of gaming when 3D first happened, and stuff, you know, was just kind of moved in that direction with the changing of narrative and whatnot. But, you know, it is best to do, as always, what best serves the art. Because at the end of the day, while, you know, C-suite people and stuff tend to think that business and art are divorced, in my experience, the best way to make successful business when it comes to games is to make successful art.
Yeah.
Art will sell itself.
Absolutely. Kyle, any closing thoughts, or are you just Googling Frieza?
No comment. I don't know how to top that. That was a great way to end it there from Charles. Agree.
Everybody remember the good smart things that Charles said and not me talking about Popeye and cake.
But the cake is a lie.
It is. And that does it for this week. If you want more, we do have it. But Why Though is on Blue Sky at butwhytho.net. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, which is free, or donate, which costs money, by going to butwhytho.net/support. Either of those actions helps us keep the lights on. We have more than one light, helps us pay our writers, helps us make the content that you enjoy, like this podcast. So go check that out. Go to butwhytho.net, read Kyle and Charles writing there. And yeah, guys, thank you so much for joining me this week. I hope that you at home enjoyed listening to that, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for having me.